we would like to begin this podcast by acknowledging that the land on which we record is the occupied, traditional, and unceded territory of the Stalo First Nation.
Lots of it is relationship building and building, again, that point of trust, because you don't know what someone's going through. You don't know what they've been through. And a little bit of humanity never hurts.
Welcome to the Ending Poverty Together podcast. I'm Shalane, and we're here to discuss big questions about poverty in bite-sized ways. Nick Wells is a media relations specialist with Union Gospel Mission in Vancouver, BC. He joined in December 2024 after spending over a decade working as a journalist in Canada and Europe, where he covered politics, public safety, and human interest stories. Welcome to the podcast, Nick.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad I could be on here today.
Yes, it's great to have you, and I'm looking forward to this conversation. Maybe we could just start with, for people who are not familiar with Union Gospel Mission, you could just tell us a little bit about the organization you work with.
Yeah, we're an organization that has been based in Vancouver for nearly 90 years now, if I've got my math correct. And we started on the downtown east side, and we've now expanded. So we're in the Metro Vancouver, Lower Mainland area, as well as we've started an outreach team on Vancouver Island in Victoria. So from our kind of roots on East Hastings, we've expanded outwards to Mission, Langley, Victoria, and it's a really beautiful thing to see. So we are trying to meet people with where they're at. You know, we help with addiction recovery and that kind of journey of recovery that someone may be on, as well as supporting people into housing and just kind of finding a stable path in life.
What are some of the ways that, you know, when you say supporting people and meeting them where they're at, what are some of the practical expressions of that through UGM?
Yeah, I think for us, it's coming from a place of trust, right? And building that kind of connection with people through maybe our outreach team or maybe our mobile mission team, which is a van that goes around outside of some more urban areas, so kind of more hard to reach places for people, meeting people who may be sleeping rough or like camping, and then kind of forming that first point of contact, that first communication, because you know what, they may not be ready to experience recovery. They may not be ready to go and do what we think of as traditional housing. And so by forming that first point of contact, building that trust, building that relationship, we're then able to kind of show that we are there for them and potentially get them help further down the line if they want it.
You've mentioned in your answer there a few of the, or some of the issues that people are experiencing, some of the things that you're encountering. What are some of the key points of pain, perhaps, that people are experiencing today, and how at UGM are you coming alongside?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting thing, because as we've seen with the ongoing affordability crisis, lots of things have changed. So we are seeing more seniors accessing our shelter services. Wow. So we saw a spike back in COVID when that happened. We started seeing a spike of people over the age of 55 start to access our shelters more often. And, you know, it was interesting because I was talking to an outreach worker who's been working on the downtown east side for about 30 years. And he said to me, you know, 15 years ago, if you were 40 to like 50 and using a shelter, you were seen as one of the really old guys. Wow. And now we have someone who's 82, we have a kind of low 80s. And so it's really showing us what the demand is for our services and how we can help people at very different walks of life than maybe they, and sorry, very different times of life than maybe they had planned for. And then on top of that, kind of building on that affordability crisis is the demand for kind of food services. So we give out about 750 meals a day across all our locations. And we've also got an emergency hamper program too, which is through our Women's and Family Center. And so people can come access that and get a collection of food that's healthy. So like pasta, your kind of staples, as it were. So pasta, canned goods. And that, again, started during COVID when people were having to practice social distancing. And now we've seen a lot of demand increase for that. So last year we gave out about 4,000 of the hampers. This year we're on track to give out about 8,000.
Oh, my goodness. That's double
in a year. Yeah, so there's a huge demand for it because of the affordability crisis. And I think this kind of comes into what we are witnessing as a growing crisis when it comes to food insecurity, because we as a society need to understand the kind of trauma that that's causing as well, when and what it's leaving in its wake. And, you know, there's obviously holistic responses to what we can do. And there's also looking at what the public can do, what various levels of government can do. But yeah, that is definitely something we've come alongside of. You and I can tell that prices are skyrocketing at the grocery store. And for someone for someone who may have comorbidities or like may have concurrent mental health and health problems, along with experiencing homelessness, they aren't able to just go to the grocery store like I can when I'm out of milk. And so that's something that we're witnessing, and we're just trying to figure and chart out a path for that.
I've had people ask in these kind of conversations about how does this being a handout play into the bigger issue? And is it actually creating more dependence long term? How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I think one that comes from a place of kind of stigmatization. People, you don't necessarily know the reasons why people are seeking out something. It could be they've had a rough day. They could be they've lost their job. We are seeing people who, like I know for our kind of mobile mission team in Victoria, we're seeing people who are living paycheck to paycheck and sleeping in their car. So the idea that because of someone's place and circumstance, they don't deserve a helping hand is a sad thing to hear. And, you know, when it is interesting, because I believe food banks themselves weren't intended to be a permanent solution back when they were kind of created. And so that's my understanding of it. And so it is this kind of interesting discussion of how much do we rely on food banks and the kind of services that they provide. But what does that say about our larger society and what we can do to help bring about change? Is it in what kind of responses? And I think largely when we look at it, it comes down to, as a society, how can we make life more affordable for people? And but yeah, that's kind of my long roundabout answer to
I think it's helpful, because I think when we don't look at it holistically and we don't see a larger picture here, then it's easy to be critical of a particular program. One of the things that stands out from just what you were saying is when you said our mobile ministry team, and then they know that this person has experienced this, or that this person is sleeping in their car. To me, that speaks to relationship, not just handout. Like these hampers are part of something bigger that's going on within the work of UGM.
Yeah, and so I should clarify that the hampers are administered through our Women's and Family Center here in the downtown east side.
Right.
But our mobile mission team does give out snacks, hot drinks. In Victoria, they give out tents occasionally to help people. And so, yeah, lots of it is relationship building and building, again, that point of trust, because you don't know what someone's going through. You don't know what they've been through. And a little bit of humanity never hurts.
When you look at kind of the wider cycle of poverty, how do you see the work of UGM, maybe even specifically the work of the Hampers program, how do you see that fitting in? How do you see it providing steps forward in this issue?
Yeah, and I think looking at our kind of larger programming, you know, like I said, we offer up to 750 lunches and dinners every day in Metro Vancouver. We have clothing and toiletries available for people so that they're able to come and get clothing. Maybe they need a shirt for a last minute job interview that they didn't know. So we have a spot for them to come in and do that. And, you know, also we're working to provide help for people wanting to make a change or feeling that they're in a spot where they can make a change in life. And so, you know, like at our Women's and Family Center, women can stay there for up to 5 years and have their children with them as well.
That is so beautiful.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing. It is. Yeah. It's really fun because our offices are close by, so you can hear kids yelling and screaming and just being kids, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And there's also, like, there's daycare. And so it's providing a space where women who may be trying to escape an abusive relationship or may have lived experience with substance use are looking to make a change and get out. And this provides them that kind of first step and that first kind of welcoming spot.
And can I just jump in, because I don't want a listener to miss the 5 years piece.
Exactly.
That 5 years of stability, I don't know that I've heard of other programs, or certainly not many. It's maybe 6 months, maybe a year, but the stability and the security that that brings to people to know that they will have housing, safe housing, for 5 years is pretty incredible.
Yeah, for up to 5 years. And so it's like, it's obviously going through different parts of our program that they're able to get that. Mm-hmm. But, and they, like being a program participant and everything, but it is something that is a really helpful and secure spot. Like I know I've talked to women over there who are excited to have their kids move in, and their kids are able to like plan what the room looks like. It's also just a really beautiful space too. It's really warm and welcoming. The lots of sunlight gets in, and the suites come furnished, so then people don't have to worry about furniture when they first move in.
Wow.
So yeah, it's a really beautiful spot.
And when someone moves into that, I'm just curious about this, because it feels like it is part of this bigger discussion of how many different issues are being addressed. Is there programming that happens within that housing? Are people in individual kinds of programs? How does it play out?
So this is my kind of basic understanding as someone who's still new, is that yes, there is programming. So you are working through programming with our Women's and Families team, and you're attending kind of class sessions or group sessions as part of the kind of agreement to be staying there. So you're going through and staying with all these, you're doing all these things as part of it.
So there's supports in place. It's not totally, like just housing is provided.
No. There's also kind of subsidized daycare downstairs to help with childcare, so that, you know, a program participant can really do the hard work of focusing on recovery too, because it's those little things that may be detracting from your ability to focus on that. You're caught up in the nowness of it, of like, I need to do this. I need to find a place to stay. I need to find a meal. I need to look after my child. And you don't necessarily have the time to focus on your recovery itself. And just by taking those kind of basic things out of the equation in a positive way, then you're able to focus on your recovery and focus on your healing too. And that's, I think, when we look at food insecurity, can I bring it back to that? Is that when we look at it, that there is a spot where if housing is supported, or if there is an ability to have housing, then you can focus on other things such as food, because you're not worried about where you're having to sleep every night. Or in terms of affordability, you're not worried if your paycheck is going towards rent or food. There doesn't need to be that kind of differentiation. So you're able to then have something covered and then build out and kind of strengthen the other kind of pillars of your life too.
This really feels to me like it is addressing some of the intergenerational cycles that can happen as well. I don't know if you want to speak to that a little bit.
So in 2021, there was about 5.8 million Canadians living in food insecure households. As of 2024, that's now 10 million. And so and when you look further, about 40% of Indigenous populations are food insecure, and 29% of all children are food insecure. Wow. So that's one in three children don't necessarily know where the next meal is coming from. So that's a huge kind of cornerstone of generational trauma. If you as a parent aren't sure how you can provide for your child and are feeling that kind of angst and shame, rightly or wrongly, of just carrying that shame with you, then that's going to be passed down onto children too. Like if you're going to the grocery store wondering if you can afford everything you have in your shopping cart or your basket, that's that kind of secondhand anxiety obviously does travel down. And when we're looking at nutrition as well, that's another thing, is mm-hmm. that ability to have healthy food. So mm-hmm. like with our emergency hamper program, is we give out these healthy food options. We also give out a gift certificate to a local market. So people can go shop for something that may, like some vegetables that maybe they want, like maybe they're accustomed to cooking certain types of vegetables, or mm-hmm. in the case of one grandmother I spoke to, because she has teenage granddaughters now who are mm-hmm. more picky, and it's a moment for them to kind of have a bonding moment of like, oh, what do we want to try? Like, they had never tried dragon fruit before. Okay. And they're like, oh, let's try this. And it was a chance to have an experiment and kind of build that positive relationship around food and have that kind of positive relationship around food bleed into their own personal lives too. And it started addressing those kind of generational trauma bits that we just mentioned.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that I think UGM is really great at is community support. When you think about the organization you're part of and you think about community support, what are some of the key things that come to your mind?
Connection in general just means that, right? Like I have spoken about the mobile mission team. Mm-hmm. But that connection can come from other places here of just outreach and being able to talk to people on a regular basis, having that community. We have a run group that goes 3 times a week with men who are program participants. So they're able to form that community among themselves as well.
A run group as in
a run club. Yeah, it's a run club.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I wasn't sure if it was an acronym for something or if these people if you're actually going running. Okay.
Yeah. So it's a run club that goes every, I think, 3 days. And so, or 3 times a week rather. Okay. And so they're able to kind of go and do that. There's a bike group, which is also not an acronym. I do mean cycling.
Okay. Cycling,
and then,
yes.
And on the women's side, there's workout programs as well. So, I mean, those may sound very basic, but it's a chance to form community and form connection. And on the women's and family side, there are women with younger kids. So I know, speaking to women over there, they all know each other's children.
Mm.
And so that's part of like the part of that program over there, which is semi-supportive programming. It's not just rental housing. So
right.
That part is where you can stay for up to 4 years. There's a 1 year program before for what we call our sanctuary program. So 5 years in total for women.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really just being able to form that connection with other people. Cause when you're in active addiction or struggling, you may not be able to form that. You're focused on basic survival needs. And so that's I think also why we have our kind of recovery coaches here, why we have our outreach teams, is all to help build and foster that connection with people and see if they want to give back.
Are those individuals you just mentioned, those staff, are they present at some of the meals that are served? Like you talk about serving, is it 750 meals a day?
750 a day, yeah. So we...
Wow.
Yeah, so across our Metro Vancouver location. I volunteer down there, so I've helped out with meals. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we're all kind of present. So in our building here, in the main floor is where the kind of cafeteria lunchroom is. You can volunteer to help prep. I spent about an hour cutting cucumbers the other month.
There's a lot of cucumbers.
They just kept coming. So our outreach staff kind of administer that program, make sure that that people are flowing through, that we're not running out of food, that we're giving enough tickets. And then we also have major meal events too. So the major holidays, Christmas, Easter, we just had a summer barbecue in New West, which is one of our Metro Vancouver locations. And then 2 weeks before we had it in Vancouver. So it's a big kind of community barbecue at a nearby park. We're giving out burgers, hot dogs, and then Thanksgiving and everything too. So these are all kind of staff who, at least if not take an active part in it, we're at least witnessing it every day too.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that people who have come through your programs end up participating as volunteers in some of these community activities?
Because I do know that there are staff who were once program participants and are now staff here. So I do know that. That is just part of their life and how they've wanted to kind of give back and move forward on their own journey.
Well, that they've ended up as staff is pretty exciting too. And
yeah,
it speaks to their experience, I would say, that it was meaningful enough that now they want to make that their career choice.
Totally, yeah.
Nick, when you think about someone who doesn't know anything about UGM, what mm-hmm. are maybe two or three pieces that you would say, this is really what motivates staff at UGM? This is what really characterizes the work of UGM.
Yeah. And so I would think it's, you know, it's kind of our continuum of care is the first one. Mm-hmm. So like we talked about, meeting people with where they're at and helping them on their journey of recovery. Obviously, we are a Christ-centered organization as well. Mm-hmm. And lots of it is, to me, is about forming those connections with people, forming those relationships, and helping mm-hmm. uplift people through supportive housing, through our meals, through our run club, all those mm-hmm. kind of things of helping people kind of see the positives and find ways through their addiction and feel better about themselves.
Mm-hmm. We haven't really specifically talked about the addiction programs. Do you want to touch on that a little bit?
Yeah. There's a women's recovery. So women can stay for up to a year. And then on the men's side, there are recovery programs, shelter and gateway. So shelter is where someone just stays the night. And so that would be someone, our kind of regular shelters. So it's all this kind of flow through of where you are at a certain time. So like if you are detoxing, Gateway is more likely the kind of place for you versus sure. housing, because it's not realistic to expect someone who may be in very active addiction go from living on the streets to, oh, you have a house now and you have to take care of it and you have to do all that. That's unrealistic, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and so it's about breaking it down into manageable pieces and making sure that someone can take care of themselves and focus on the important aspect of taking care of yourself, which is such a large and draining part of recovery as well.
Mm-hmm. Trauma is addressed in all the work, I would imagine, at UGM. Are there specific ways that trauma is being addressed?
So we do have counseling here, so people are able to see counselors. We have an Indigenous relations and cultural safety team as well. So people who identify as Indigenous are able to meet with our elder and also work through that as well. So there's like reflection circles on Fridays, and there's are kind of those ways to just kind of address that, those deeper issues that may lie behind it as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we all know that root causes of things is what actually affects lasting change and sustainable kinds of change. And just the Band-Aid approach doesn't work long term.
No, and I think that's why it goes back to those looking at what are holistic responses to things too, right? I mean, figuring out what kind of wraparound care can there be to make sure that someone is supported in all aspects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. Our time is coming to a close here very quickly. I'm curious, was there anything else that you were just hoping I would ask you today?
Yeah, I think just going back to food insecurity one last time.
Yeah, for sure.
Is looking that one, like raising awareness with the public is important. As we talked about, food banks were never meant to be a permanent solution.
Right.
And we need to, as a society, look at ways to help with food insecurity. And that also comes to government. We need all levels of government to prioritize more funding for programs to address food insecurity. And that could be school lunch programs, but those are not year round, right? So there's a big kind of gap in the summertime. I think it's the awareness that this is a year round crisis. This is not just, during the winter months, people are more affected. This is a year round ongoing crisis that needs to be seen, because we've seen an increase in BC at least of the number of what's classified as poor children. So it was 21,000-ish in 2021, is up to 147,000 in 2022, which is the latest data I can see. So that's the largest single year increase in BC in 20 years.
Oh my goodness.
So that says a lot about the kind of world we're living in. And
I don't think many Canadians would know that almost 30% of children don't know where their next meal is going to come from in this country.
No,
that's shocking.
There's an interesting stat I found in a report too, is if you were a single parent raising a child with a minimum hourly wage of like 15-22, I think this is when this report was written,
okay.
So a couple of years ago, you would have to work an extra 1,000 hours without payroll deductions to close the income gap to make the threshold of what is considered low income.
Wow.
That's mind-boggling when you think
that
about that.
That is mind-boggling. No kidding.
And so that's kind of what you're up against when we're looking, when we talk about this holistic change and these need for kind of structural changes.
Mm-hmm.
Is if that's what's blocking just being considered low income, then that, what is blocking you from like thriving as well? And that's why there needs to be a look at how do we make housing more accessible and more affordable? Because once that expense is dealt with, people can then focus on health and wellness and food as well, right? So there's all these kind of different things that like that you or I may not think about. And again, like, yeah, the extra 1,000 hours one is just a stat that I knew I had read it and I couldn't really believe it at first. I was trying to figure out how long ago this was, but I think it was 2022 at the latest.
Wow. Anything else?
No, I think that's it for me. Thank you so much for having me on today. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And thank you so much for all the work you do. We are blessed to have UGM in the Lower Mainland and doing the work that's happening around here, and grateful for people like you who are spokespeople for the work so that others can learn more about it. So thanks so much for being here, Nick.
Thank you.
If today's episode has sparked questions for you, or you'd like to learn more about Food for the Hungry, please email me at podcast@fhcanada.org.